Please be seated. So I'd already called ADA Carbon Solutions versus Atlas Carbon, so you're out of time now. But if you want to argue, I guess we'll let you. Mr. Schaefer?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. The primary merits-based issue for the court to determine on this appeal is whether the district court's award of damages to ADA after a bench trial complied with Wyoming contract law. Indeed, ADA does not...
Counsel, can you start with a jurisdictional issue?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The jurisdictional issue is that the court asked for supplemental briefing on whether or not subject matter jurisdiction attached to this case from its inception. One of the things that the court addressed or asked the parties to address in supplemental briefing is whether or not it was two different distinct LLCs, whether their membership was completely diverse with the membership of our client ADA. In our, there was a preliminary round of briefing that I believe addressed one of the court's concerns, went down to the district court and came back up, and now at which resolved that portion of the subject matter jurisdiction issue. And then over the last 2 weeks, the court identified an additional issue involving EKT Investments Limited Partnership, which is a limited partnership that was, I believe, formed under the laws of Louisiana that has a general partner, EKT Inc., that is a Florida corporation, and then a series of individuals and I believe trusts, generation-skipping trusts, that act as limited partners. One of the things that was submitted on the supplemental briefing was that the analysis from Atlas, at least, and these are members of Atlas LLC, Your Honor, is whether or not the members of the trust entities were completely diverse from ADA, and whether or not the court, how far the court had to go into determining the members of, or what would be the members of the limited partnership, if it could just stop at the general partnership, or if it had to go to the limited partnership as well, and then dig in further to the actual citizenship of the beneficiaries. One of the things that at least we noted in our supplemental reply or response was that the analysis from Atlas did not go down to each level that was required of analyzing an unincorporated entity such as a trust or an LLC, essentially anything except for a corporation. And therefore, without that analysis on if there are any beneficiaries currently in that in those three generation-skipping trusts, we can't really determine at this point. We don't know one way or the other whether or not there's complete diversity jurisdiction.
So is that your position today, that we should remand for determination of these issues? What is your position?
My understanding of the federal courts, both the district court and this court, Your Honor, Judge, I did bring up a good point, is that this, it is both coming upon, or was to be incumbent upon the district court, and then this court to resolve itself of the jurisdictional issues. And my understanding of the federal case law is that subject matter jurisdiction either existed or it did not at the time of filing, and that we cannot determine one way or the other whether or not it existed without a full accounting of all the members of those unincorporated entities. That is the law. I'm not going to disagree with the law. And I think that the appropriate thing to do here is to remand to the district court to make the appropriate factual findings as far as whether or not the parties are completely diverse.
Aren't you going to need discovery?
I think we'll need limited discovery, but it also depends on cooperation of Atlas and what information they can continue to get out of their membership, because ultimately...
Yeah, I thought it was a member of a member. It was a member of a member of a member. that you don't know their form.
Absolutely.
And you don't have access to these people, but they could be subpoenaed or whatever, couldn't they?
Absolutely right. Or, you know, limited requests for production, limited interrogatories. I think it could probably be dealt with on a simple affidavit as to whether or not, as of the date of the filing, if I recall correctly, it was July 25th of 2022, whether or not there were any beneficiaries, actual beneficiaries of the trust. And if so, where they lived, so that we can determine the full citizenship. And I think that an additional step that should be taken is to analyze each and every one of the entities that are identified in the corporate disclosure statements from Atlas to ensure before this matter would come back up to the court that we've fully resolved all issues and gotten to each and every level that's required to get to for an unincorporated entity to satisfy both the district court and ultimately Your Honors on whether or not parties are completely diverse.
What if there isn't diversity?
If there's not diversity, then there was no jurisdiction to begin with in the court. And unfortunately, 3 years of litigation will have to be unwound and it'll have to be refiled in Wyoming State Court. It's okay. Obviously what we would like to avoid.
Well, there's some doctrines that allow lack of diversity to be cured post-trial, dismissing a party or something like that. I don't know if this partner of a partner of a partner or member of a member of a member transferred its interest to avoid diversity, whether that cures it. But there are some doctrines. Have you looked into that possibility?
Your Honor, I haven't. Only for the sole purpose that we have only two parties to the case. We have an LLC on one side and an LLC on the other side. And it may be the situation if you have multi-parties that you could satisfy that issue by dismissing a party. But post-filing change of ownership of a limited liability company and how that would affect potentially an equitable consideration on determining subject matter jurisdiction, I have not looked at that particular issue.
Anything else on jurisdiction? Okay, let's get to the merits.
No, certainly.
In case we have to decide that.
So the merits-based issue here is whether or not the court's determination that essentially ADA was only allowed or entitled to damages for 9.5 weeks of loads of activated carbon deliveries from Atlas complies with Wyoming law. Under Wyoming law, contract damages are designed to place the parties in a position as if the contract had been performed. And what happened here was the court determined that, and we don't dispute, that there was a contract, there was a breach of the contract, that there was harm to ADA, and the ADA was entitled to damages. Our quibble with the district court's analysis is that the district court cut off the amount of damages that ADA was entitled to by making a factual finding that ADA had impliedly terminated or impliedly exercised a right to early termination under the party's supply agreement, and that effectively ended the party's contractual relationship and limited ADA to only $76,000 worth of damages. This was a multi-year complex transaction between two parties that are in the activated carbon space, both doing business in Wyoming. There was a total, under the contract at the time, as of the date that the district court determined that there was this implied termination, there was still approximately 1.4 million pounds of activated carbon to be delivered to ADA under the trial period, and then at a minimum, another 5 million pounds of activated carbon to be delivered in what was termed as contract year one, another at a minimum 4.4 million pounds of activated carbon to be delivered in contract year two, and then a minimum of 3.2 million pounds of activated carbon to be delivered in year three.
And your damages were like 10 cents a pound?
And we don't quibble with the district court's finding that on average, that because of the breach, ADA incurred an additional 10 cents per pound upcharge or surcharge to go and find covering products.
What was the cost per pound total?
The cost per pound total, don't have that right in front of me, Your Honor. I apologize. It was under the contract. The parties had a fixed price contract that was, I call it a modified fixed price contract that had some modifications built in over the 3-year contract period. I believe it was in the range of 56 cents per pound. And that on average from the two suppliers, the ADA was able to, in a very tight market, find covering product for that on average, it cost them an additional 10 cents per pound more.
So what was your client's obligation under the contract? Was it obligated to buy that much for each of these yearly terms?
Once the contract term, once the trial period or the initial phase of performance ended, then ADA was in a take or pay situation. So it either had to accept deliveries of $4 million of, for instance, first contract here, Your Honor, it had to either accept delivery of 5 million pounds or pay for 5 million pounds. Contract year two, same thing. Either had to accept delivery of 4 million or pay for it. So that was the risk that ADA took on.
What about during the trial period?
During the trial period, it was 2.56 million pounds.
That you were obligated to purchase?
That we were obligated to accept and purchase before there would be a transition to the subsequent 3-year terms. Yes, Your Honor.
So you couldn't, I mean, if you were going to terminate, you could be liable for not purchasing the extra, the undelivered.
If our clients did not terminate during the trial period, then yes, they were on the hook to either take the poundage or pay for the poundage. And I think that the issue with respect to the district court's termination is in the contract language. It's in the proof's in the pudding. So essentially what the district court found, Your Honor, was that Atlas was unwilling to meet the orders or the demands from ADA, whereas the actual contract language says that ADA has a right, kind of an off-ramp during the trial period to say, if applying commercially reasonable terms, it appears that Atlas is unable to meet the contracts, the product specifications or the quantity demands, then it could early terminate. That use of unable, I think, is an important one, because unable is not the same as unwilling. Unwilling is, that's a breach, that's a default, that's what the court found. And that would entitle ADA to the full measure of damages, Your Honor.
And could you terminate before the first year contract without any damages?
Yes, Your Honor.
You could terminate again after the first year?
No, Your Honor.
If you went through the trial period, then you either terminated or you entered into a 3-year binding agreement.
And that's a good point. It's a nice segue into my final point before I'll try to reserve some time for rebuttal. But that there's been some discussion or issues raised in the briefs about essentially the trial period being a condition precedent to the remainder of the contract term. And I think that the appropriate way to look at it or frame it is that the end of the trial period was an extinguishment of the ADA's contract right of early termination. Once that 2,560,000 pound got delivered, ADA's right to terminate and get off the agreement early was done. It was over, and it was in the agreement. And if Your Honor would permit me, I'd like to reserve the remainder.
Well, you took, what, eight? We were down to 8 minutes when
yep.
you started. No, I don't think, maybe you're opposing counsel wants to talk about jurisdiction, but I think you carried the burden for both of you.
Okay.
So you get another 7 minutes of time on the merits.
Did the trial period ever really end here? I mean, the kind of the parties walked away before the end of that trial period, right?
And, yes, Your Honor. And
the district court found that that was a breach by Atlas. And,
yeah, I believe the district court used words like sham acceptance, and that mm-hmm. ADA got jerked around after Atlas had determined that it was going to reinitiate performance obligations, essentially. And that's where the force majeure component of this case comes in. Of course, there was a force majeure declaration in early July of 2022.
But you want damages from July of 22 through year three?
Yes, based on the minimum expectations of the parties, Your Honor, correct. But I think you can, whether it's from July or from November, you know, there was a manifestation from Atlas of its unwillingness to continue to perform under the contract. And I think the force majeure provision of it is, or the circumstances surrounding the force majeure are important and perhaps evident of what eventually the district court got to in saying there was a bad faith, essentially bad faith breach of the contract, is that there was no, Atlas didn't back away from their, you know, the fact that they exercised their force majeure, that their right to force majeure and suspend the performance under the contract based on ADA's unwillingness to agree to an increase in price. The force majeure provision is very clear that the event of force majeure in order to be an appropriate exercise of that contractual right is that it had to actually affect performance. Performance here under the agreement was Atlas delivering activated carbon to ADA. And as came out at trial and was in fact undisputed was that at the time that that Atlas had suspended its performance to ADA under the contract, Atlas was experiencing a record demand of its activated carbon product. And that when it finally, because of litigation expediency, decided that it was going to reinitiate performance obligations under the contract, that and when ADA said, okay, we'll take our, you know, two loads per week, which was the party's usual custom, Atlas said, well, you know, we have our pipeline filled with orders all the way essentially through the end of the year. Performance was never an issue.
Yeah, but the district court, viewed the force majeure provision as considering a significant increase in costs as being a force majeure event, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if that were the case, then it had at least a good argument that it had encountered that situation, didn't they? Or do you disagree with that reading of the contract, of the provision?
I think even if we accept that as an appropriate reading of the contract, I think that it's nonetheless the erroneous conclusion because of that final clause of the force majeure provision, which said only to the extent that the event affects performance.
But didn't, I thought the someone from Atlas, maybe it was their president, testified to how much more expensive things got.
Yes.
Why wasn't that adequate?
Well, the expense of the materials or the expenses that increased for the company didn't bring production to a halt. It didn't bring demand to a halt. It didn't shut down the factory.
It made it much more expensive. I thought the way the district court interpreted it, if it just gets much more expensive to perform, you could perform and lose money, but we're not going to make you perform and lose money. That's the way the district court read the contract, I thought.
And I respectfully submit that that's an erroneous interpretation because of that last provision, the last essentially sentence of the force majeure provision says that to the extent such event actually affects performance. And while they testified at trial that the costs of production went up, they also testified that all the rest of their customers had agreed to a price increase and that they were able to continue production, they were able to continue performing, that they held out on ADA only because ADA would not agree to increase the price. So while they testified that their performance got more expensive, they did not give any testimony that the increase in cost prevented them from actually running their plant and producing the activated carbon.
As long as it got paid for it.
Right.
But I think the way it interpreted the provision, if it made it so expensive that you'd since have to go out of business, then that was a force majeure event that would permit them not to perform. Do you disagree with that?
I don't disagree that that's the way the court interpreted the provision at trial. And in issuing the bench memorandum. But I think my point is, Your Honor, is that there was no testimony in that the increase in price prohibited it from actually producing, or the increase in cost prohibited it from actually producing its product.
But the language it relies on that it said applied here, maybe you're disagreeing with that, was if one of these events makes performance impossible, which seems to be the way you're interpreting it, or economically or financially impractical. So that would seem to apply if, yeah, I can do it, but I'll lose a bundle and go out of business. So that's economically or financially impractical. Do you disagree that that language applies here?
I don't disagree that it applies, Your Honor, but...
You don't disagree.
I don't disagree that it applies. I guess my point that I'm trying to make is that there were other customers that Atlas had, and that they testified that they agreed to a higher price, which increased their margins, and they were able to continue production. So, you know, at what point does the force majeure event of increased cost, with time, you know, when does that stop?
Well, you know? It's when it becomes economically or financially impractical. So you're conceding a number of things I didn't realize you were conceding, such as that language about economically or financially impractical. You're conceding that that applies here, but then isn't the issue whether this the increase in cost made it economically or financially impractical to sell at the terms under the contract?
I think in that sense, Your Honor, I understand what you're asking now, and I apologize if I was unclear. We have two broad points as far as the language of the force majeure. Obviously, the one is the last sentence of the provision, which I've referenced a few times, is that the whole entire paragraph is subject to proof that it actually affected the ability to perform. And my point on that particular provision is that that Atlas essentially isolated that only to ADA. Otherwise, it was able to actually produce product and give it to customers. If one customer made it more expensive, I think that that did not impact its ability to perform.
The clock hasn't been running. I'm not sure.
That is true. It's been stuck on 4:05.
Excuse me. Is there a problem with the clock? It's been at 4:05 for quite some time, I think.
I thought I was standing. Had time standing still.
What did you do?
Some sort of voodoo.
Whatever trick. I'm sure there are lots of counsel who would like to learn to do it.
I'll be giving lessons out in the on the hallway after argument. Second issue with respect to the financial impossibility or impracticability. So we think that there was an incorrect interpretation as far as what that particular clause was referring to. It was referring to, I believe, the acts of civil authorities, changes in the law that caused performance to be more expensive or financially impractical. And I think that basic contract construction would dictate that you have to read the force majeure provision in the context also of the broader agreement. And one of the material parts of the agreement, particularly for ADA, was that this was a fixed price agreement. So the ability for it doesn't make sense to interpret that that provision as giving either party carte blanche anytime it got more expensive for them to perform, the ability to declare force majeure, particularly in light of the fixed price.
If we agree with you that the district court erred on the force majeure, what implications does that have for your damages theory?
A few months. Your Honor, I think you get to a kind of a overarching point with respect to damages, is that we tethered our breach and default arguments essentially on the force majeure. I think as far as damages go, this was not damages measured on time. This was damages measured on poundage. Mm-hmm. So the damages assessment is essentially, you know, how many pounds were left on both under the trial period and then on contract years 1 through 3 at the time of the breach. And the answer is it doesn't make a material difference because after the force majeure, they didn't deliver another pound to us. So the damages analysis is going to be the same.
Well, does it matter that you never made a demand for more deliveries after December?
That we never made more of a demand? No. Another important point, I think, is that we had both a money damages remedy and then also we had asked for specific performance. That was what we were in the lawsuit to do, was get them to specifically perform under the agreement. And when it became clear that absent a court order, specific performance, that they weren't going to go back to pre-force majeure course of performance, that's kind of, I think, what stopped. The other thing that stopped is that final email that Ms. Cooper sent in November talked about different processes, different revisions or terms that they had adopted in that apply to their orders. And that was going to be different from what the parties had originally agreed to. So therefore, that was, I think, a repudiation potentially of the party's contract. At 50 seconds left.
The force majeure clause makes a difference for a 6 or 8 week period, does it not?
It does.
Okay. I thought you said it didn't make any difference.
Well, it doesn't make a difference with respect to how you're going to calculate damages. Because the damages are
methodology. But you don't get any, if force majeure provision actually protected Atlas for that 6 to 8 weeks, then you don't get any damages for what happened at that period. Is that right?
We get damages but for when things started back up and okay. The amount of poundage that was left on the table. Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. My name is Jeff Pope. I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Atlas Carbon. I'd like to start very quickly with the jurisdictional issue. Mr. Schaefer covered a lot of it. I did want to mention that in this latest request for supplemental briefing, I did reach out to the and spoke with the president of EKT Investments. The difficulty that I encountered was they were not excited to provide information about some of their limited partners, which is why we were unable to provide the court with the names of beneficiaries. I was in fact told they didn't know who the beneficiaries were. And for a couple of the trustees, well, one, Bessemer Trust Company, I was told to, quote, research that for myself. So as the briefing indicates, I attempted to do that. Unfortunately, it appears there's a plethora of Bessemer companies, or at least companies that bear that name. So that's at least the difficulty in regard to that. But everything else Mr. Schaefer said, I have no reason to disagree with. So,
well, why don't you stop and start his clock at 15 minutes now? So, go ahead.
Well, does the court need to invoke legal process to find out from your clients, you know, what the facts are here? It seems like we have a jurisdictional duty to figure this out.
Potentially, Your Honor. The difficulty we encountered with the law was how far the onion gets peeled back in these scenarios. The case that we cited with regards to identifying for jurisdictional purposes the citizenship of a trust was in relation to a case where the trust was a party. So obviously in that situation, you have to establish citizenship for purposes of diversity. We couldn't find any cases that talked about this scenario where, I think Judge Hartz, you put it, a member of a member of a member, which is EKT Investments LP is the member of my client. There is a general partner, a limited partner, and of those limited partners.
But it does look like we need to know that. And you can you not depose these people and get process to do that? This fellow doesn't want to do it. Might feel differently if he got a court order.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I don't disagree with that at all. I think we could if we needed to do discovery.
And that could avoid a tricky legal issue also.
Sure. Yeah, I would like to come with the power of the court if I had to, as opposed to a phone call where you can tell me to pound sand if you want to.
All right. Okay, now we'll start on the merits.
Turning to the merits now, I'd like to start with the termination question. Because from our perspective, ADA has improperly framed that in order to raise questions about what the scope of damages really should be. And here's why I say that. The district court did not make any findings about repudiation, material breach, waiver, or any of the other arguments that ADA raises in its briefing. Instead, what the district court found is that under Wyoming law, you can exercise contract rights by action, by word, or by conduct. And the district court, and these findings are not challenged here on appeal, found that ADA invoked Section 21 of the contract, which gave it a right during the trial period to terminate all its obligations, cease performance, if it was to be found that Atlas couldn't consistently meet the specifications in delivering the product. An important fact here for your honors is the parties stipulated that Atlas was never able to deliver a single pound of activated carbon that met the specifications in the contract. In fact, one of the kind of larger issues at trial that's not present here on appeal was, why was that? Why was Atlas having difficulty meeting those specifications? There was expert testimony on that front. And, you know, as Atlas's expert explained, that it was impossible, given the manufacturing process that Atlas used, to meet that. So the district court found that, based on the plain language,
ADA Carbon took it all and just mixed it with other product to get something that was acceptable.
Correct,
Your Honor. So they were willing, it didn't meet specs, but they were willing to take it.
Certainly, Your Honor. That was the testimony at trial. But the plain language of Section 21 did afford ADA the right to unilaterally terminate. And the district court found that ADA's silence, ceasing communication with Atlas after November 10th of 2022, met that standard of conduct to invoke that right.
Well, that concerns me because of what could happen, and what seems to have happened here. Say you have two parties with a contract like this to supply goods at a particular price, and the party's supposed to, the supplier, just decides to jerk around the buyer and deliver slowly, never keep promising and then not delivering. So the buyer just says, I give up. I'll go look elsewhere. I don't want to waste my time with these folks because they're just not going to perform. At that point, I would think the buyer could get entire contract damages for the entire period of the contract and say, this is what I lose from this. I'm going to have to pay an extra 10 cents a pound for this product. And if your theory, if the district court's theory is correct, then that's an easy way to limit damages in these sort of contracts. Just screw up, so on, because ADA never explicitly said canceling. What they did suggests total frustration and say, okay, we'll just get our damages for what how they didn't perform. Tell me what I'm missing.
So I think there's two important responses to that, Judge Hartz. The first is the sham acceptance that Mr. Schaefer talked about and or jerking around, depending upon how you want to characterize it. That was related to a very specific element in the contract, namely that there were specific timelines about when an order has to be placed and when Atlas had to accept the order. But the terms of shipment or fulfillment or whatever you want to call it are not present in the contract. And so the assumption—
There was no provision saying you have to deliver within so much time. Okay.
Correct. And we argued, and the district court didn't really reach this, but that Wyoming's UCC would provide a fill-in for that.
A reasonable time.
Correct, Your Honor. And so the district court found the acceptance was insufficient, but there was no finding that a delivery or a fulfillment would never take place. The second important thing—
Never or would not take place within a reasonable time?
The district court made no findings whatsoever on that front. But one of the important findings the district court did make is it found that all of the witnesses were credible. It had no reason to disagree with what the witnesses testified to. And both Atlas witnesses, the CEO, as well as the head of sales, Ms. Cooper, all explained that Atlas stood willing to fulfill those orders had ADA confirmed. Now, Mr. Schaefer alluded to the November 10th email, which was the final communication between the parties, did lay out some new procedures that Atlas had adopted, and those had historically not been present. That is true, but there is no basis to assume that Atlas would not have fulfilled the dates that it had specified for the better part of 2 months, saying, ADA, if you would like these two orders, we will fulfill them on this date and on this date. That is undisputed in the record, and the district court made findings that those were credible documents and as well as testimony.
How did the district court then deal with the repudiation argument?
The district court didn't confront that argument, Your Honor. Admittedly, it was a close call in briefing this case about whether we wanted to raise a waiver issue. There were, at least in our mind, some statements made during closing argument that maybe suggest that ADA was trying to argue for repudiation. But the district court made no findings on repudiation. ADA and its proposed findings and conclusions did not suggest repudiation. But critically, Your Honor, I think you can resolve that one on the law. The Rusalis case and the Skyco case, which we've cited in our briefing, very clearly say that under Wyoming law, delay, insufficient performance, breach, uncertainty about whether you're able to perform cannot rise to the level of repudiation. It has to be an unequivocal statement or act that you are not going to perform the contract. ADA doesn't cite any evidence in its briefing where Atlas said that. Instead, what ADA attempts to do is take statements that don't say that and say, well, you should construe them as such. So, for example, ADA says the force majeure clause was a repudiation. Well, there's no language in there that says that. And as we point out, that creates a weird dynamic where if you're invoking a contract right that allows you to suspend performance, to read that then as total repudiation, we can't find any cases that would support that proposition.
The refusal or the failure to deliver because you gave new customers, Atlas gave new customers priority over the one that had a contract, the customer there was a contract with, that could not be construed as a repudiation?
No, for two reasons, Your Honor. The first is those same cases, Rusalis and Skyco, say that a breach, which assuming ADA's interpretation is correct about this, thou shalt supply us first, that would not rise to the level of repudiation. And second, Atlas did not have a duty in the trial period to supply ADA before any other customer. What ADA is attempting to do is conflate some terms, and I'll unpack those right now. So the trial period does not have it lasts for this long a period of time. Instead, it's a quantity-based period of time where once you deliver a certain amount, you transition to the contract years, which do run on an annual basis. They have what's referred to as an annual quantity. And the provision that ADA is citing for this provide us first specifically says that Atlas has a duty to provide the annual quantity before it supplies other customers. The plain reading of that is that kicks in when we're in contract years 1, 2, and 3, but not in the trial period. Now, admittedly, the district court didn't reach that issue. That legal argument wasn't phrased and presented to the district court.
Was there any good faith and fair dealing argument here?
Well, actually, so that is what the district court ultimately found, is that there was a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing based on how Atlas accepted the order within 1 day. It would send a communication, but then say, we're going to fulfill later than what historically the parties did.
Breach of good faith and fair dealing, but then damages for that are cut off because ADA, as a result of the breach of good faith and fair dealing covenant, implied covenant, can't practically deal with Atlas anymore. It's just too unreliable. They need the product. Why would that not be the proper interpretation of what happened here?
I would submit this, Your Honor, that there's no facts to support the ADA could no longer work with Atlas piece of that. If there were facts in the record to suggest that, testimony from ADA, for example, then maybe we have a different argument.
ADA did not put on evidence about how it was impacted by these delays?
It did. It put on evidence about ordering cover product, but ADA never had any of its witnesses say, we had lost all faith. We're never going to be able to get product. They won't deliver it. Here's why. None of that is in the record. There is an assumption, at least how the briefing is laid out, that that's the case. But there's no facts in the record.
An assumption by whom?
By ADA. That when Atlas sent its final communication in November 10 saying, if you'll confirm your order, we will fulfill it on these dates, that the assumption is that was a lie. That there was never going to be a fulfillment at that time. Again, that flies in the face of the credibility findings from the district court, and it doesn't have any supporting evidence in the record. The last thing I will note on this termination issue is two things. One is the specific performance piece Mr. Schaefer raised. Yes, they argued that as an alternative remedy, but they didn't ask for that. They didn't brief or argue any of the equitable factors under Wyoming law. And in fact, the seeking of money judgment of a money judgment and the millions of dollars they sought disproves the theory of specific performance, which under Wyoming law, you need no adequate remedy at law. The second thing, just note, in the reply brief, there's an argument about a material breach, another way to sort of access full contract damages. That's a new argument that was not raised in the opening brief or below. We would request the court find that waived.
I'm sorry, what issue was waived again?
In the reply brief, ADA argues that the way this court should view the termination damages issue is from a material breach perspective, citing cases about material breach under Wyoming law, what that means, and what kind of damages that unlocks. That wasn't raised in their opening brief, and it wasn't raised before the district court. So,
what else would you seek damages for except a material breach?
Well, Wyoming law, the law that they cite, and maybe we have a terminology difference here, talks about cases where you can consider the breach so total that your obligations terminate regardless of what the terms.
That's what they argued in your view.
In the reply brief, that's what they explicitly argue. They don't argue that in their opening brief or below. So it's just an alternate way of attacking the district court's findings about the cap on damages.
If we disagree with the district court on the force majeure interpretation, what does that do to the court's award of damages?
It would open up about another 4-5 week period of time where you would do the 10-cent cover price at 2 truckloads per week.
Would that require remand?
I think the court could probably do that math based on how the district court did its math, but it could remand.
Well, that's what I thought came coming in here, but when I see that the damages is just 10 cents a pound for the remainder of the contract term, what difference does it make if there was a 6-week drop? Did they incur any, I mean, they had to pay 10 cents a pound extra, and it doesn't matter whether a non-delivery was before or after or during the force majeure period.
I think it matters from this perspective, Your Honor, that because the court found that force majeure was properly invoked based upon its terms, there were no damages for that period of time because it was not a breach.
Yeah, so, but the damages are just based on how much mm-hmm. was supposed to be delivered under in the trial period versus how much was delivered, and the force majeure issue doesn't affect that, does it?
I understand now, Your Honor. So that's actually not how the district court calculated damages. So the district court said Atlas began resuming performance on, and I don't remember the exact date, I think it was sometime in August is when that notice went out. From August to November 10th, when the court found there was a termination, that's the period of time for which the district court calculated damages. So our view would be—
How did it do that? How did it determine how many pounds they had to pay the 10 cents extra?
The parties had historically delivered, Alice had fulfilled 2 truckloads per week, and a truckload is, I believe, 40,000 pounds. So it was 80,000 pounds a week times 10 cents for the duration the court found there was a breach.
And that period would be longer if we rejected the force majeure period.
Correct, Your Honor.
Basically 4 or 6 weeks of 2 deliveries.
Okay.
Correct, Your Honor. I see I'm out of time. Could I briefly just address one issue on force majeure?
Yeah.
I just want to correct something. I think the court, based on its questions, understands the terminology issue and the interpretation issue. I want to address this idea that other customer, Atlas was able to fulfill other customers. That is an incorrect reading of the agreement. Section 12, which is the force majeure clause, the very first part of that clause says, quote, if performance of this agreement or any obligation under this agreement is prevented. And then it goes on to define those force majeure events. So this idea of there's evidence that Atlas supplied other customers under different contracts has no bearing on the legal or factual findings related to the force majeure clause. So unless the court has questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there some time remaining?
Four minutes and five seconds.
Oh, right. You can have 45 seconds.
I think I've had about 25 minutes to argue, so I'll try to be as brief as possible. I think the termination question comes down to the use of unable versus unwilling. I think what we had here was a party that was unwilling to fulfill their obligations on the contract. That's classic. That's classic breach. One thing I wanted to bring up for the court's attention, this concept of time, that the performance of the trial period was not a matter of time, but of poundage. So essentially by prolonging the deliveries, they could hold essentially ADA and kind of trial period purgatory. And there is a time is of the essence provision in this contract, which I think is important with respect to the party's obligations. Thank you very much for your time. I very much appreciate it.
Case is submitted.